This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, FM 90.9 HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Kids are naturally curious, so then why do so many of them dislike school? We'll explore that question this afternoon with the help of a cognitive psychologist. Our guest is Daniel Willingham, author of the book Why Don't Students Like School? If you're a person who is curious about the brain, I think you will find the book fascinating. In it, Daniel Willingham looks at 9 principles fundamental to how our brains work. At the outset of each chapter, he poses a question a teacher might have about how we learn. In addition to why don't students like school, the questions posed include, why do students remember everything that's on television and forget everything I say? And how can I teach students the skills they need when standardized tests require only facts? The answers Professor Willingham supplies contain surprises. Here's one. Contrary to popular belief, the brain is not designed for thinking. It's designed to save you from having to think because the brain is actually not very good at thinking. That's the beginning of the answer to the question, the first question. Why don't students like school? Listeners, I look forward to your phone calls for our guest, Daniel Willingham. Join us with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Daniel Willingham is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. About 9 years ago, his research focused on the brain basis of learning and memory. Today, his research is dedicated to the application of psychology to kindergarten through 12th grade education. You'll find our guest online at www.danielwillingham.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Daniel Willingham, welcome. How are you?
Very well. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. My pleasure. Well, 2 questions here at the outset. Why aren't our brains good at thinking? And if we're not good at thinking, how do we manage to get through the day?
Great questions, both of them. So I would amend it slightly. I would say it's not so much that we're not good at thinking. It's that we're not good at thinking relative to other things that our brain can do. So thinking is, when I say thinking, I'm defining it very broadly as you're sort of confronted with a problem. You want something to happen, and it hasn't yet happened. So thinking includes, how am I going to select which loaf of bread to buy at the grocery store? How am I going to prepare dinner tonight? How am I going to balance my checkbook, and so on? When we talk about thinking in those terms, when you're confronted with a problem that you haven't solved before, thinking is a pretty unreliable mechanism. It's also fairly slow and fairly effortful. When you think about it, when someone just, you know, poses a riddle to you or something in one of those brain teasers, it takes you a long time to try and come up with the answer usually, and sometimes you might not even get it. That's what I mean by thinking is unreliable. You may or may not get the answer that seems acceptable at all. Compare that with memory. If you've solved a problem before, if you routinely buy bread, or if someone poses, you know, a brain stumper to you that you've heard before, you don't need to engage this long, effortful process of trying to think it through. And instead, you know, you just draw from memory. Oh, right, yeah, I've heard this one before. Roosters don't lay eggs, or whatever the answer was. And similarly, when you're in the grocery store, you could sort of rack your brain and say, okay, so let's really think outside the box on this one. Let's try and choose a great loaf of bread here. I'm going to compare all 55 varieties in terms of their nutritional content and their visual appeal and how good I think they are, you know, likely to taste and cost and so on. But you're probably not going to do that, right? You're probably just going to buy the same type of bread you always buy.
Yeah.
Or you'll just sort of buy something impulsively. And so this is what I mean when I say the brain isn't really designed for thinking. When you think about it in sort of evolutionary terms, using memory is benefiting from your experience. If you've solved a problem in the past, then the solution was okay. You know, things seem to work out all right. it makes a lot more sense to just draw the previous solution out of memory that you've used before that was acceptable, rather than using this process that's quite slow and effortful and may not even yield an answer at all, much less a good answer.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting point of this discussion that you opened the book with. Despite the fact that we're not good at it, we like to think when the conditions are right.
Absolutely.
So what makes for the right conditions?
Right. So this is, and this is when you ask people, do you like to learn new things? Most people say, yeah, I do enjoy learning new things. And this is what they're talking about, right? So I'm painting, thinking as if it's this terrible process that nobody would want to engage in any time. But in fact, that's not true at all, right? But when you unpack it a little bit, you realize, okay, we do like to think, but really we like successful thinking, right? It's not fun to hammer away at a problem and feel like you're not making any progress at all, right? A math problem or something that's really kind of beyond my reach. I don't want to work on that, right? So it's successful thought, but even more than that, it's successful thought that is not too easy. So by the same token, if you handed me a math problem that was, you know, really designed for somebody in second grade, that would, let's hope, be too easy for me, right? And I wouldn't even feel like I had solved the problem at all. So solving problems does bring pleasure. It does give us this sort of mental snap of satisfaction. Mm. Everybody's familiar with that. It feels good to come up with a good solution to a problem, whatever the problem type is. But there's sort of a sweet spot of difficulty. And I think we're for problem solution, and I think we're very good at sizing problems up when we first encounter them. And problems that have this characteristic that you size it up very quickly and say, well, this is one that I don't see what the solution is immediately, right? If you were just going to draw from memory, like the second grade math problem, you would see immediately, oh, right, this is not going to be fun for me because it's going to be mechanical work, and that's not interesting. And simultaneously, a problem that's way beyond our reach because it's too difficult, you can evaluate that pretty quickly. So when we see a problem that seems somewhere in between and hits the sweet spot of difficulty, that's when we're intrigued. That's when we want to pursue it a little bit because we know with a little bit of work, I'm going to get that pleasurable feeling of having solved the problem.
Mm. And that's got to be all caught up in why we enjoy mastering something.
Absolutely. And of course, there are other aspects to it, too, right, that feeling, you know, gaining mastery of something brings social benefits and so forth. But there is real pleasure in mastery, just as you say, for the reasons you described. It's also pleasurable to see someone else who has really mastered something.
Right. And that's why we pay to go to the theater.
That's right. And that's, you know, that's why we listen to car experts on the radio talk about how to fix cars, right? It's an improbable show when it's described to you, right? But it's fun listening to somebody who really, really knows about something diagnose problems.
Yeah.
But it's also worth mentioning, I mean, this gives you some insight into the problems that teachers confront. Because if what I'm saying is right, that in order to intrigue somebody with a problem, mm-hmm. it has to be pitched at just the right level of difficulty. Here's a teacher with a classroom of 25 or 30 students, most of whom have different levels of preparation, right? And some of them, for example, know a whole lot already about U.S. history. And so a problem that is appropriate for them is going to be way beyond the reach of the child sitting next to them. That's a significant problem, I think, in schooling today.
Yeah. So how do we help provide a snap of satisfaction for that teacher?
Yeah. For the teacher, there are other rewards, one hopes. But if you're saying sort of for the students, and the teacher's going to get it when the students get it in part, right?
Yeah.
I don't see a way around this other than doing some sort of grouping, where you're giving students work that is appropriate to their level of expertise. And I think that's very tricky, and many teachers and policymakers are uncomfortable with doing that. If you do it within a classroom, it's much tougher on the teachers because they're trying to have several groups going at the same time. That's the way it's typically done now. It used to be much more common to track by classroom, and teachers and educational researchers felt that there were a lot of sort of collateral damage in doing that, and it really didn't work out very well.
Mm. I'm calling on a memory here now. I have as a child learning to read, and there were reading groups within the classroom.
Right.
And the teacher spent time with each one.
Right.
And while one group was working with the teacher, the other groups were at tasks
right.
designed for them.
Right. And if you've got an aide in the classroom, that certainly helps as another adult. The most common thing that people, that both kids and adults perceive is that, you know, you try and have names for these groups that don't really tip off the kids. There's the Redbird group and
right.
the Bluebird group. And, the first graders understand very well.
Oh, definitely.
Redbirds, right, are the kids who are, you know, reading better than we are. And so how does that make you feel as a Bluebird, right?
Right.
This is an enormous problem, and you don't want to send the message to the child that early, my gosh, you know, that, so maybe school really isn't the place for you, right? This is an unspoken message, right? Already things don't seem to be working out that well. I think that's an enormous danger. And I think something that can be alleviated to some extent by the teacher and the teacher's attitude, that the teacher can emphasize in spoken and unspoken ways that these are not ability groups. Ability implies something that's intrinsic to the child. This is who you are. You're a slow reader. You will be a slow reader. Just as you have blue eyes, you're going to be a slow reader, right? This is not the conclusion you want the child to draw, but rather, everybody's good at some things, everybody is not so good at other things, and everybody can get better at anything that they work hard on. And, yeah, you know, maybe you're not reading quite as well as some other kids in the classroom right now. That's fine. You know, continue working on it. You're going to get to where they are and beyond.
Mm. What role does the environment, that classroom, play in intelligence, this particular environment we're talking about, the classroom?
Depends a lot on what you mean by intelligence, right?
Okay.
Very, very charged word, and lots of people use it in different senses. And it depends, too. I mean, there are so many different factors in the classroom. I think when we talk about intelligence and we think of it in just sort of the everyday sense of people who seem to learn things fairly quickly, you know, pick up new information readily and work with it in novel ways. The classroom does, more than we realized 10 years ago, the classroom and sort of incidental factors do move around intelligence, it seems. So, for example, a lot of this work has been done on the effect of racism in intelligence. That if you highlight to an African-American child their race and highlight the fact that really that's all you need to do is highlight their race to them, in many situations they will perform worse on intelligence tests than they otherwise would. This is very, very startling to a lot of people, but it seems to be a fairly consistent effect. So I think that what's happening in the classroom clearly does affect intelligence, intelligence defined pretty broadly, and probably in ways, some ways that we know about now and in other ways that we probably can't even guess of.
Hmm. How do we go about enriching environments, in particular for children, so that they can be who they can realize their gifts and talents?
Yeah, yeah. So there are a couple of really important points embedded in that question. So the first is, what are our goals for schooling? Right, and this is something very few people pause and think about. So sometimes people just sort of cavalierly say, or not cavalierly, but casually at least say, you know, we all know that the point of schooling is economic competition. Reforms for the schools are sort of pitched in that level, that if we don't do something about the schools, our kids are not going to get competitive jobs, right? And that sort of strikes a chord with people, and people usually respond positively to that. But you could have a totally different vision of school, which is a little bit more in line with the way you asked your question, which is school is not just about getting a job. School is about sort of self-actualization, self-fulfillment. So that the child who might be a gifted musician and have real talent and interest there, should the schools be doing something to nourish that, or are we just completely focused on economic competitiveness? So that's the first thing that I think there really needs to be, ideally, a national conversation about, is what exactly is it we want schools to do? It's difficult to know whether schools are fulfilling their mission when the mission hasn't really been defined.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second question would be, okay, once we define the mission, what can we do to create environments that are going to be maximally enriching for children? And, you know, that's obviously a really rich and complicated question. One thing that a lot of people are focused on, have been focused on in the last couple of years, is making better connections between schools and parents, because we know that the home environment is at least as important and probably a good bit more important than the school environment. And the two leverage each other. If you have a parent who cares about education, they're not only doing stuff at home, they're involved in the school, and that can make the school better.
Yeah. We also know that there are a lot of parents who cannot be involved in the school for one reason or another.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we're dealing with a situation then in the classroom where the teacher and everybody else in the building that's an adult has to almost ramp up the effort?
That's true. And I mean, I think it puts schools and teachers and administrators in a very difficult and in my view, sort of unfair position, that saying that this is the sort of no excuses movement in schooling, and the idea that you know, if you say these kids are coming from a home environment where education isn't valued or where parents don't have time for them or whatever it is, that's not an excuse. If you're complaining about that, you're making excuses, and it's up to the school to step in and fix it. That's asking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying the school shouldn't do you know, absolutely everything possible to help every child, but we should also recognize that sort of we may be in danger of making excuses for parents or letting parents off the hook or something like that. That, you know, parents do have responsibilities for their child's education as well as the schools.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Daniel Willingham. He's a cognitive psychologist, and he's the author of Why Don't Students Like School? A Cognitive Scientist Answers Questions About How the Mind Works and What It Means for the Classroom. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. If you'd like to join us, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You note in the book that when we start to talk about what should be taught in school, we pretty quickly find ourselves in a political thicket. So you propose this question: instead of what should we teach, what knowledge yields the greatest cognitive benefit?
Right.
Talk with us a little bit first about the difference in the questions and how you answer the second question.
Sure. So the root of this is really comes from reading. And it comes from what I think is a fundamental misunderstanding about how reading works. Most people, including most educators that I run into, unfortunately, think of reading as what's sometimes called a formal process, meaning it's a skill, and you can plug any content into the skill. So, and sometimes you hear this, you know, once a child knows how to read, they can, you know, the sky's the limit. They can do anything. And that's true to a certain extent, but it sort of mischaracterizes reading. Reading really has two pieces. The first is a skill that can be applied to any text, and that part of reading is decoding. Decoding is the word people use to mean looking at letters and sounding out what the sounds are associated with the letters and then putting that together into a word. So knowing that the letter C sounds like K, and the letter A sounds like A, and the letter T sounds like T, and so forth, right? So that part's straightforward, and everybody more or less agrees on that, and there's even now belatedly some agreement on how that ought to be taught. The second part of it is much more subtle, and this is the part that people miss, which is you need to already know something about a paragraph, a story, whatever it is, in order to comprehend it. And people appreciate this easily when you're talking about listening. So if you're talking to somebody who is, I don't know, the cement expert of the entire world and knows everything there is to know about cement, and they start talking to you about cement, you can well imagine saying, okay, wait, I'm not getting any of this. You need to slow down, and because I don't know anything about cement, so go slow, right? And talk as if you're talking to someone who doesn't know anything about cement. Exactly the same thing is true when you're reading. It's no different reading than it is listening. If something is written in a way that assumes you have certain knowledge, well, then you better have that knowledge or you're just not going to understand what's written. Now, this gets really tricky when you're talking about writing versus listening, because when it comes to listening, I can stop the person and say, I'm sorry, I don't know anything about cement, or I'm sorry, I don't know anything about biochemistry or whatever it is. You can't stop the writer. The writer has to make a guess about what their reader knows and doesn't know. Right? The writer is going to leave some stuff out because to the writer, it's perfectly self-evident that this is true. And if I, as a reader, share that knowledge, no problem. Right? Then I fill in the blanks. But if I lack that knowledge, then I don't understand what's going on. So think about this for a moment. People who write for the Chicago Tribune and the New York Times and Time Magazine and so forth are making these assumptions just like anybody else. They're leaving stuff out because they assume that their readers have that knowledge. Right? When they mention President Lincoln, for example, in passing, they may assume that the readers know who President Lincoln was, what he did, that he had a reputation for great honesty and integrity, whatever it is. And so this creates an enormous problem in a reader if they don't have that knowledge. So this was what was behind the comment I made that you cited, that thinking about what we conclude children need to know, I think really needs to be considered in light of this cognitive fact about reading, that the main driving force behind reading comprehension, once kids are able to decode, once they're in about fourth or fifth grade, the main thing that drives performance in reading is what you already know. And so when I think about that, when I think about my children in school, I think, well, what do I want my kids to be able to read? I'd like them to be able to read the Chicago Tribune. I'd like them to be able to read, you know, serious works of fiction and nonfiction and so forth. Okay, what do those authors leave out? What do they assume that their readers already know? That's what I want my kids to know.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call. A listener in Peru, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Interesting topic. You know, all I can say, just from my personal experience to the kids of today's generation, study, 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 get as smart as you can, be the best you can of your generation, because it's extremely difficult to do anything anymore. And I'm beginning to wonder if the college degree is actually, I want to say it's almost equal to what the high school diploma used to be years ago, when not everybody could go to college, and you still have a lot of people, I'm talking way back like 30 years, there's so many people that have diplomas and degrees and whatever out there nowadays. You got to constantly keep updating yourself, kind of like what teachers do. On a conscious basis, go back and, you know, go to the seminars, whatever, you know, career that you can, do a lot of volunteer work, because I've done that in the past. I find myself at 52 years old trying to change 180 everything I've learned, everything I've done for the last 30, 40 years, because the money is not there, the jobs have been going away, and you find yourself in a situation where you have to multitask and have learned two different careers. So all I can say is I kind of got myself into this boat a while ago by not sticking, like, with computers or, in, you know, getting more savvy to that, because I think I would be have a leg up on the average guy. But yeah. I could just say, please, 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 kids, study. I don't care if you have problems. Get help. It doesn't pay to be in my position. It's very strenuous. It's very, you know, it's just not good. Anyway, I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. So let me respond to a couple of things the caller mentioned. The first is sort of comparing what a degree means today versus what a degree means, what a degree meant 30 years ago. I'm sort of interested in that, but the main thing I'm really interested in is what a degree means today in the U.S. versus what it means in other countries, and not just because of economic competitiveness. I mean, I'm interested in that too, but I think other countries are really instructive for what's possible. Sometimes we're, you know, we get very caught up in what's going on in this country, and we say, well, okay, well, that clearly we can't do that. And then if you look at other countries, you see, okay, that thing you just said can't be done. Other countries actually are already doing that. And so when I think about comparing degrees, I mean, I think about where our high school students are. And the truth is, compared to industrialized countries, we're pretty much at the bottom in terms of science, knowledge, mathematics, and reading. We're pretty close to the bottom. And so we've got a lot of work that we need to do. The second thing that the caller was said a couple of times was study, 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 mm-hmm. work, work, work. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to that. One of the chapters in the book I talk about is the necessity of practice. And for certain types of skills, like if you want to be good at mathematics, there are certain things that really have to be committed to memory. You really have to learn math facts. You know, you've got to know and be able to pull from memory instantly that 8 plus 5 is 13. If you have to stop and calculate it, it just slows you down too much in getting to more advanced mathematics. And that's just one example. There are many, many of them. But in general, the only thing we know of that really brings expertise is practice. Now, that sets up a pretty big challenge for teachers, because practice in general is not that fun, right? Doing the same thing over and over again, who in the world wants to do that? And so the challenge for a teacher is finding ways to give kids the practice they need so they become really fluent in those skills without making the classroom a place of real drudgery and boredom.
Yeah. Isn't that why we learn the alphabet by singing it?
That's one. Yeah, that's absolutely one thing that you can do is find memory tricks that will make it easier to learn things. And, you know, that set of memory strategies are called mnemonics by people who study memory. And mnemonics were really frowned on for a while because they sort of lead to this rote knowledge. And my view is rote knowledge in general, this is, you don't want kids to have only rote knowledge, but there may be times when teachers feel like at this point they're going to learn this, it's not going to mean anything to them, but they've got to have this under their belts before they can get to the more meaningful next stage. And so let's go ahead and sing a song or do whatever it takes until they've got this knowledge at their fingertips, and then we can move forward. And I hate to, you know, sort of make teachers afraid to do that, to think that, oh my gosh, you know, this is rote learning, this is terrible, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. Used in moderation, it's absolutely the right thing to do.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I think you really do need to know your multiplication tables cold.
Yeah.
And I had a teacher, she's not, in some respects she was a great teacher, in some respects she was a horrible teacher, but she had us, once she learned that most of us in the classroom did not have that down cold, she made us do it every morning, write them out.
Yeah.
And at first it was absolute drudgery, but then she switched it around and made it fun, and she said, okay, today we're going to do the threes, the sixes, and the nines. And we're going to see if we can get them done, you know, within a certain amount of time. And she built little games into it. So,
yeah.
So she, and by golly, we knew it cold by the time we, you know, after a couple of weeks.
It's interesting. I had a pretty similar experience, although it wasn't slightly different. I also had a very conceptual introduction to multiplication, and I remember doing things with Venn diagrams and doing things with yarn and manipulatives and all that, and they clicked. It worked. I really felt like I understood multiplication, but I was never asked to memorize the multiplication table. And it wasn't until I was in sixth grade and I switched schools and I was really struggling in math that my teacher in sixth grade quickly saw what was happening. She said, "I'm sorry, you've got to memorize the multiplication table." And it took me a couple of weeks, and I did. And math, you know, the sixth grade math I was working on became a whole lot easier for me. Although it was a little while before I would admit that.
Of course.
Right.
Of course. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Daniel Willingham, author of Why Don't Students Like School? A Cognitive Scientist Answers Questions About How the Mind Works and What It Means for the Classroom. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener in Bloomington, Illinois, on line one. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I hope you haven't already addressed this. I just got on about 10 minutes ago, but I wonder, you know, what does the guest today think about the school system in the U.S., maybe in Illinois? You know, is there a way to shift the way we teach? It just seems to be so global, and I wonder if that reaches the majority of our citizens. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, and this goes back to something that our guest Daniel Willingham said in response to our first caller this afternoon. You know, we're at the bottom.
Yeah.
And I guess the question here really is why, and
yeah,
what do we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you've got something as complex as schooling, and then you figure the answer is going to be complicated also, right? There's not going to be a single reason. I should also expand a little bit and clarify. When kids leave high school, we are pretty much at the bottom among industrialized nations. We're not at the bottom in fourth grade. We're not at the bottom in eighth grade. Okay? In fourth grade, we're probably in the top third, around there. And then we drop somewhat when you get to eighth grade in international comparisons. And it's only when you're looking at kids as they leave high school that things really look bad. I think, again, I'm confident there are lots of reasons this is true. One of the reasons, I believe, is what I was alluding to before, which is the importance of knowledge and the importance of content knowledge on many of these different skills that we want kids to have. So I think the reason kids look so good in fourth grade is a fourth grade reading test is mostly covering decoding. And we're pretty good at teaching kids how to decode when it comes to reading. But then we're not teaching them a whole lot of content. There was an amazing, very large-scale study that where observers just went into classrooms, about 800 classrooms nationwide, and just recorded what was happening in kindergarten, in first grade, in fifth grade. And what they discovered was an enormous amount of time spent on reading, very little on math, and almost nothing on science and social studies. And so I think that fixation on reading, and, you know, we can't kid ourselves, the way accountability has been construed has no doubt fueled this. The fixation on reading and this very narrow view of what reading is has really hurt us in the end. Now, mathematics and science, a different story. Science, kids aren't going to be good at science unless there's some science in the schools. And science doesn't start in a serious way in this country until sixth grade, eighth grade, something like that. In other nations, it's starting much earlier. The figure is, I'm not sure I've got this exactly right, it's less than 5% of the week is spent on anything remotely related to science in first-grade classrooms in this country. So if you don't spend any time on something, it's no surprise that eventually you're really going to fall behind.
Mm. It seems to me that in other countries there is a lot of attention paid to learning another language.
Yes.
And it seems to me that there's a question here somewhere about what does learning another language do in terms of the development of the brain and our cognitive powers?
That's a great question, and it has been of considerable interest. I think the main cut is that if you're this wouldn't be the reason to give kids to teach kids another language. If the main idea were, well, this is going to sort of transfer across all sorts of different thinking domains, and you know, bilingual kids just are able to solve problems more creatively, or they can think in different ways. We know that there aren't any huge effects like that. There are definitely some smaller effects, and they're sort of pocketed here and there. But as far as we can tell, there aren't, you know, large-scale effects, like it just makes you 20% smarter if you know another language. Mm. Now, there might be other very good reasons for us to want foreign language instruction. And again, this gets back to what we were talking about earlier in the hour. You know, until we know what our goals are for education, it's really hard to set priorities.
If you were setting those goals, what would you select?
Gee, that's a great question. See, I like not being in charge. I like being that guy on the sidelines who says, oh, well, that's not very effective. I'm just kidding. I would like to see some mix of the two. I would like to see some mix of sort of the self-actualization goal where, you know, if you have an ability, you're going to be able to see that flower and come to fruition, and also some mix of citizenship and civic responsibility, that we think about what do you need to be a good citizen in this country, and we make sure that everybody's got it. And I think if you have some combination of those two, the economic benefit will take care of itself.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Daniel Willingham. We're talking with him this afternoon about his book, Why Don't Students Like School? Our guest, Daniel Willingham, is a cognitive psychologist. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. Today, his research is dedicated to the application of psychology to kindergarten through 12th grade education. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got about 8-9 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us this afternoon with a question and a comment, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good afternoon. Interesting topic. In addition to learning foreign languages, I found with my son learning how to play musical instruments, reading music, was very, very helpful with him. As a matter of fact, he was an excellent student and played not only one instrument, but he played several. And I just wanted your guest to maybe respond to that.
Sure. So there have been studies on whether this will work across the board. Let's just, you know, every kid needs to play an instrument because that's going to make them better thinkers. As far as we can tell, if that's true, it's true in a very small way because that people haven't really found robust effects. But much more persuasive to me are sort of, for some kids, I have no idea whether this applies to the caller's son, it can be very, very motivating because it shows them what the payoff is for hard work and for success. And there are actually national programs, a number of them in South America, started by an imitation of a program in Venezuela, where kids from really underprivileged homes are asked to... Hello?
We're still there. The caller just hung up.
Okay. Where kids from underprivileged homes are given an instrument, are given instruction, and so forth, and the anecdotal evidence is overwhelming that this is an enormous success for these kids. And amazingly, I just heard the other day, really rigorous research has been done to, you know, verify that it works. I'm ready to believe it does, but somebody ought to do some research on this to show that it actually does. So that's another way that I think playing a musical instrument can be tremendously helpful for kids.
Mm. It seems to me there's got to be a benefit to exposing children to all kinds of possibilities.
You mean academic things to learn and
right.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I mean, when people ask me what makes for a successful family environment where the kids are going to succeed at school, that's the number one thing that I mentioned that I think is really important. And let me be clear, I don't have great data. This isn't based on solid research. It's really just based on how I think families and the mind work. Families where education is important, there's this constant unwritten message. This is who we are. This is what the way our people in our family are. We like to learn new things. We're willing to work at it. And when we go to the zoo, we don't just look at the animals. We read the placards, you know, and we keep a dictionary by the kitchen table so that when someone uses a word that we don't know, we can look it up right away, right? These are the attitudes that lead kids to feel school is for me. School is where I belong. If I have a setback at school, that doesn't matter. I'm going to be able to overcome it.
Hmm. One of the things you say in this book is do whatever you can to get kids to read.
Yes.
What is the key to getting kids excited about reading?
Part of it is modeling, right? So telling your kid there's nothing more important than reading, and then turning on the latest reality television program is not, right? So that's obvious, right? Being a good model and trying to ferret out the type of reading material that your child is really going to enjoy. I mean, I think librarians are absolutely invaluable resources in that. Librarians have tons of experience with kids. They know so much about books. Rather than trying to figure it out on your own, I would, you know, talk to a librarian. And I am a fan of minimizing the things that are basically taking time away from reading, you know, limiting the amount of time that a kid can be on a computer or playing video games or watching television and so forth.
Yeah. What would you suggest for a student who has had difficulty reading or who has not been encouraged to read?
Yeah. So I think the first thing is to be sure that there is not some sort of a reading disability. And reading disabilities can come from lots of different places. I think there are, and it's a minority of cases of reading disability where there's some like little glitch in the mind or brain, that there's something that just didn't work out quite right. And it doesn't matter whether it's a genetic thing or whether it came from someplace else. Who knows? Most of them can be overcome, but there aren't very many that are like that. Most of the people have trouble reading. It's because they weren't taught to read in the most effective way. So that's the very first thing. If you don't like reading, check out whether some of the really, really basic skills need to be polished a little bit. After that, if there isn't any sort of a problem like that, but the child just doesn't like reading, I would say look for materials that are closest to what the child is currently interested in. Again, you know, getting advice from other people and see if you can entice them that way. Start with where they are and try and move from there.
Let's take one more call this afternoon. A listener in Bloomington, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for a great program.
I ask you to turn your radio down, listener?
It's off.
Okay. I don't know. We're getting feedback for some reason or another.
Wait a minute. I can fix it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, that was, I had my other phone on.
Aha.
It's really interesting. I was so afraid you were going to say, oh, the teacher should do this and do that and everything. So this is really, very nice and helpful. Two things. I just wondered, I kind of missed what you said in the beginning about the brain not being really designed to think.
Uh-huh.
And then the other thing is I am a Montessori teacher. I've taught her for a number of years and not now, but seems to me Montessori was designed and said much of what you have said many years ago, and it's designed for children to work at their own speed and their own appropriate time for each thing that they learn.
Right.
I don't know how much you know about Montessori, but
So let me say a couple things. One is I am pretty familiar with Montessori. In fact, my kids attend a Montessori school. My wife is a Montessori teacher and administrator of a number of years. And we actually met and got married just as I started getting interested in education. And so this is a little bit of a negotiating point for her. She's like, all right, so if we're going to get serious here, I need to know how you feel about Montessori. That's fine. I think Montessori is terrific, and I do. And I think that the caller's absolutely right. A lot of what I'm advocating, Maria Montessori was saying at the turn of the 20th century, she's absolutely right. And, you know, without getting into a huge number of details, there, I think that we have learned something in the last 100 years, but there's no doubt that Montessori was terrific in her insights and that the program is terrific. The other thing I wanted to respond to was that the caller said, I'm glad you weren't telling teachers what to do. I think that's hugely important for researchers, for there to be sort of open dialogue between researchers and teachers. And the way I can summarize it is I think I know the lab, but I don't pretend to know the classroom. And teachers should listen to what I and other researchers say and think about how that might apply in the classroom. But in the end, nobody knows the classroom better than teachers. And so I think researchers really put themselves in a false position if they're telling teachers exactly what to do.
Mm. One last question, and we'll have to be quick about it.
Yeah.
If practice is something we want to strive for, what can we do for our beginning teachers in those early months and first couple of years in order to support them?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, and it gets to very, I think, very complicated system-wide issues. So, but to keep it brief, I think you're absolutely right. Beginning teachers, you know, they were students. They were students, you know, 4 months prior to the starting their job, and then they're thrown into a classroom. They're 100% responsible for it, and very often they get virtually no support. I think it would make an enormous difference if that would change, if teachers served a meaningful apprenticeship where they actually got mentored and they got feedback from experienced teachers. I think it would both lead to much greater teacher retention. Teachers wouldn't be, you know, feel so desperate and quit in the high numbers that they do now because they felt more supported. And also, I think quality of instruction would be better.
There, we have to leave it. We're out of time. Daniel Willingham, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure.
Daniel Willingham is the author of Why Don't Students Like School? A Cognitive Scientist Answers Questions About How the Mind Works and What It Means for the Classroom. If you're a person who's curious about the brain, I think you will find the book fascinating. The book is published by Jossie Bass, which is an imprint of Wiley.